I'd like to introduce this series with a few comments. Are there people here who have not read any of the suttas, who don't have any experience reading the suttas? Because I'm going to read some, and I need to sort of set a framework for the suttas. The Buddha's teachings were transmitted orally for somewhere between 500 and 1,000 years before they were written down. The style of the suttas is very repetitive, as if they were chanted, and also as aids to memory. And so there's a tendency for them to be kind of lull you to sleep. But at the same time, there's movement in the words that's so fast that you suddenly discover that you're lost, because he's moved so far beyond where you thought he was that you have to keep going back and reading them. So they seem to have this quality. And in every sutta starts with the beginning of meditation and ends up with enlightenment. So these teachings, which are typically written down in 5 to 20 pages, encompass the entire practice of someone who's enlightened. Perhaps that's many lifetimes, perhaps it's way beyond any of our abilities, but it's there in a few pages. So hold on tight when I read, because the progress is blindingly fast. So I just need to warn you about that, and I'll point to it as I go along. But they're not like anything that we've experienced in the Western literature, not that I know of. These four foundations of mindfulness are in one sutta. It's about 20 pages. So this 4 weeks will be on a sutta which is 20 pages. The different topics that are in these foundations are covered in other suttas. There are three or four suttas on just mindfulness of the breath, others on mindfulness of the body. So there are lots, as you can imagine, in his 40 years of teaching, he repeated himself. And so there are lots of other sources, but this sutta, the Four Foundations, is one of the central suttas in the Buddhist literature. And it has a wonderful title, Maha Satipatthana Sutta. Sati meaning, so it's Maha meaning great, Sati meaning mindfulness, and Patthana meaning of the four foundations, or the four frames of reference, that is translated in various ways. So tonight I'm going to talk about mindfulness of the breath and the body, and I'll hopefully clarify why they're together as a subject. Next week is mindfulness of feelings. These are not emotions. These are the bare feelings of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. The next topic after that is mindfulness of sensations and the mind. And finally, mindfulness of the activity and mental qualities of the mind. Now, this is typical of the Buddha. He's very precise in how he lays things out. His pedagogical ability to walk you through a series of steps with very careful language and very careful discernment of what is which part of your experience is really remarkable. And this sutta is a wonderful model for this. I also want to tell you that this is a very tough sutta. I've been reading this thing now, trying to get ready for this talk, and I'm totally overmatched. So don't be discouraged by things that I say tonight that you don't understand, because I may not understand them either. But in particular, it just takes a lot of effort to begin to penetrate the things that he's pointing to. And that's why we meditate. We meditate in an effort to see how our mind works. And in particular, to see how it works in ways that are very self-deceptive, that give rise to greed, anger, and delusion. And to understand how we are caught by these mental constructs that lead to this very unskillful and unwise way of looking at life. And we also meditate with these are lifelong conditioned ways that our mind works. I can just use a simple example of the self-referencing that our mind uses. I mean, I don't know if you all have noticed this, but I am actually at the center of things, not you. And everything that I think about has I at the center of it. My mind goes on and on about this. I hope that's not happening for you, but it definitely happens for me. And it's so habitual that I'm not even aware that it's happening until I sit down and watch the stories that my mind creates and the very meager amount of material that has to arise from my mind to create an enormous lie. And then I act on it. I start to get fearful. I start to get greedy. I start to get hopeful. I start to get pessimistic, all based on things that my mind is running off on that have nothing to do with the initial input. This meditation process is an effort to cut through that and to actually see the steps that the mind is taking, and in so seeing it in a very experiential way, to try to deconstruct those habits, to try to actually see what's really going on, what that deeper reality that's underneath that surface yada 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 that the mind is doing all the time, and to see that there are, finally, bottom line, there are these three characteristics of existence that we all intellectually know about: impermanence, the fact that there's inherent suffering in life, the fact that the self is a constructed mental object. But intellectually knowing those things isn't enough. Our conditioning is so strong. We actually have to overcome that conditioning with repeated experiences of seeing how completely unreal these mental constructs are. And then we can finally start to free ourselves. And meditation is the only way that we can quiet ourselves down enough to see the blinding speed at which our mind is doing all these things, and actually start to notice the steps that it takes to go from this very bare experience of an input, just a sound, just the tone of my voice, any sense input, and then the mind taking off so blindingly fast that we're often running on some story that has nothing to do with what actually just happened. It has everything to do with our memories, our sense of who we are, and what we want or don't want. The good news is that you don't have to understand this four foundations of mindfulness to benefit from meditation. It's not the kind of thing where you have to get a diploma before you can get a job. You can actually start to benefit from meditation the day you start school. And there's a wonderful phrase that I find very heartening that's was given by the Buddha, that these teachings are beautiful in the beginning, beautiful in the middle, and beautiful in the end. And what he's pointing to in that is, don't be discouraged by your ignorance and lack of understanding. That's the human condition. You are going to benefit progressively as you see and understand more, and that will go on from the moment that you begin to see. You don't have to get to a certain level of proficiency before you will start to benefit. You will start to benefit immediately. So don't give up. The Buddha, whether it was an individual or a lineage of meditation masters isn't important here. The Buddha, or his lineage, laid out a series of suttas with very specific instructions about how to meditate. Actually, giving very clear step-by-step instructions, not only of how to meditate, but a picture of kind of what the path looks like as you progress along it. So he's giving you not only suggestions about how to construct your practice, how to go about it, but also what you can expect to uncover as you go along. Now, I find this miraculous. You know, that people could have sat down 2,500 years ago and described how our minds work, independent of culture, independent of time and history, independent of race of origin, gender, anything. And that language can be used anywhere in human history. I find that beyond understanding. And what it points to is that we, in spite of all of our belief that we are each this special person, we are actually all the same. We all have the same fears. We all have the same hopes. All of this self-referencing stuff is we're making it all up to make ourselves feel good about ourselves for some strange reason, because the irony is that you actually feel better about yourself when you let that go. But these teachings are meant to help you, and they're not meant to be daunting. But they are daunting, because this is hard work. It's hard to make progress. But let me just give you an example of the kind of breadth of practices that he talks about. This is just from the introduction to one sutta. In this community of monks, there are monks who remain devoted to the development of the four frames of reference. That's actually these four foundations of mindfulness. To the four right exertions, to the four bases of power, to the five faculties, the five strengths, the seven factors of awakening, the noble eightfold path, to goodwill, to compassion, to equanimity, to gratitude, to perception of foulness of the body, to impermanence, to mindfulness of the in and out breathing. So he's pointing in this one sentence to, you know, 15 or 20 different practices that you can spend your whole life on. Just one of those. Or you can search through this set of practices to find the thing that's right for you. And so it's a very much individual voyage where you have to keep on experimenting without getting to be a dilettante about it, because you do also have to work hard at a particular practice to get deep enough into it so that you can benefit from actually having these realizations. So you can't be changing your practice every day, just in the same way that you don't put your attention on a different part of the sensation of breathing every in breath and every out breath. That you need to stay focused on a particular way of looking at your breath so you can start to uncover what is actually going on instead of just dancing around on the surface. Quieting the mind down and focusing rather than just being all over the place. So, but he's pointing to many possibilities here. And it's important to keep open to those. Now, it's very important to remember that the instructions, when I read this, inevitably, words are being used to describe experience. And words are very limited in that way. And so one has to pay very close attention to the words, but at the same time not get limited by the word. So it requires careful looking at the words. Now, in addition to that, of course, the original language of the Buddha was in a language which was highly developed for this kind of work, and we're using English, which is not very highly developed. So we have a handicap there. And it's translated. So one has to be gentle, I think maybe the best word, patient, gentle with oneself about trying to get too much or too little out of a word. And I'll give you an example here in a minute. Now I want to start by reading the opening instructions to mindfulness of the body and the breath. And these are the same instructions that I said during the sitting, but I've just extracted some, so there's a little bit more here. How does a monk remain focused on the body in and of itself? There is the case where a monk, having gone to the wilderness, to the shade of a tree, or to an empty building, sits down, folding his legs crosswise, holding his body erect, and setting mindfulness to the fore. In other words, you're putting your mind on being mindful right here in front of you. Always mindful, he breathes in. Always mindful, he breathes out. Breathing in long, he discerns that he is breathing in long. Breathing out long, he discerns that he is breathing out long. Breathing in short, he discerns that he is breathing in short. Breathing out short, he discerns that he is breathing out short. Now you might be thinking, so far so good, not too bad. Of course, there is this word, always mindful. Always. Boy, that's, I'm not there yet. I've been sitting for 20 years. I'm not even close to always. But I do think I can tell when I'm breathing long and when I'm breathing short. But there is this word, discern, that's being used here. It's not just about noticing. Discern is a much more encompassing word than noticing. Now, the next instruction. He trains himself to breathe in, sensitive to the entire body, and to breathe out, sensitive to the entire body. So all of a sudden, in one sentence, he's gone from just being aware of the breath, and whether it's long or short, to being aware of all of the sensations, all of the experience, the bare experience now. We're not talking about emotions or thoughts. The bare experience of the entire body. All of the sensations. Feet on the floor. Cramp in the knee. Pressure on my butt. On and on. There are thousands of these things going on in your body when you start to really notice. So you're training yourself to become aware of the entire picture of what is coming up in your body. That's a really big step from discerning whether you're breathing long or short. And yet it's the next instruction. There might be a couple of lifetimes between that second instruction and the third instruction. But the suttas don't impose that on you, you know. There are people who may be able to just walk right in and be able to do that right away. He doesn't want to hold those people back. There are stories of people, we've heard those stories, of people that became enlightened almost the minute they started sitting. I don't know anyone, but, you know, maybe you guys do. And there's certainly stories about them. So he's not trying to say, you know, you got to do this for 10 years before you can go to the next step. He's just pointing out the way, the path. He's not pointing out anything about how long it's going to take you to walk this path. He trains himself to breathe in calming bodily fabrications and to breathe out calming bodily fabrications. So he's talking about getting so concentrated here that all of the normal stuff that's coming up in your body, you know how it is when you first come and sit down and you've got, you're kind of revved up from driving over here and you've got all this stuff going on. And slowly as you sit, you can start to feel yourself settling down. He's talking about, you know, way beyond this, obviously. He's talking about calming all body fabrications. calming everything down, calming everything down. So as you get quieter and quieter and quieter, you can start to discern and see more and more that's going on. Now, I just thought here I'd take a little detour and, or a little, as an aside, just give an example of when I was driving over here, I was listening to some music, and I started trying to figure out what was the bare experience in that. Just the bare, being sensitive to the body's experience, the bare experience. What is the bare experience of listening to music? Anybody have a, take a stab at that? Now, of course, I'm sitting on the car seat, just putting that aside, just focusing just on this, of all the stuff that's going on in my body, what is the bare experience of listening to music?
Hearing the notes without meaning.
Pardon me?
Hearing the notes without meaning.
Hearing the notes without meaning. Yes?
Vibrations on your tympanic membranes.
Maybe on your face too, mm-hmm. Wherever you can feel vibrations. If you don't have a shirt on, maybe even on your chest. Vibration. Vibration. The note is already a conceptual overlay now on top of that. The idea that it's a note. The idea that you are hearing it is a conceptual overlay on that. The bare experience is hearing is arising. And then hearing is passing away. All the rest of it. Beethoven's a great composer. Oh, I remember when I was out with my favorite girlfriend when that piece of music got played. All of that stuff is way beyond bare experience. And yet, if we see it, if we see the difference between just the vibration and what we then do to it, we see that we are constructing an enormous story out of just that simple arrival of a vibration on our skin. An enormous story. It has emotional content to it. It has enormous self-referencing to it. It has all kinds of stuff about who I am and what kind of music I like and when I don't like to hear it, when I do like to hear it, and blah, 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 blah. On and on and on. You know, the mind is going so fast around that stuff that it's really hard to just listen to or to just be able to stay with the bare experience of the hearing. It's really hard. But the meditation is pointing to that. It's saying, pay attention. What is actually going on? And then what are we making up after that? And the steps that you go through there are so fast that it's extremely hard. I mean, there's a step that the first step is that's very, very quick. This is a whole nother thing about dependent origination, the whole idea of the sequence of things that we do when we have a bare experience. The first thing we do is decide whether we like it or we don't like it. That is, you know, that in modern jumbo is about, that's happening back here, you know, in the back part of the brain where it doesn't even take the time to transmit it up to the front and back again. That is happening really fast. I like it. I don't like it. I want more. I want less. Those things happen so fast that we're already launched into something the instant the experience comes in. But it's possible to actually start to see that happening. And we have to be able to see it happening in order to, what he's saying here is, he starts out with, how does a monk remain focused on the body in and of itself, the body in and of itself. That's just that bare experience. Referenced to the body's experience, not referenced to the body in the world, not referenced to the mind's ideas about the body in the world. This beautiful or ugly body I've got, this strong or weak body I've got, on and on, all that stuff. That's all referencing the body in the world. The bare experience is just in and of itself. And in order to stay with that, he's pointing to the fact that you've got to actually go through these steps of becoming sensitive to what's going on in the body and then calming the body down enough that you can actually start to notice these little very rapid things that happen when you start layering opinions and thoughts and launch off into emotions and all that stuff on top of just that very basic input that came in from either a sense organ or a mental image or a thought. Now, I'm not going to read the rest of the sutta. I encourage you all. I sat for a long time before I started reading these, and I have some regret about that. I thought I'd read enough in all of the Western schooling I'd been to, so I had an attitude about reading, and I decided sitting was what I wanted to do. And I've just really started reading in the last few years, and I've realized I think for myself that was not wise. So I encourage you to sit first and foremost, but to also read. It helps because he's giving you some very helpful instructions here. He's not talking about just sitting down and closing your eyes and drifting around. As I love this thing that Ajahn Chah said, you know, if sitting was enough, chickens would be enlightened. I love that, because I can't tell you how many hours I've just been sitting there like a chicken. I mean, and I know I didn't get anywhere. And he's using words like train the mind, concentrate the mind, focus the mind. He's really exhorting you in these teachings. He doesn't BS you. This is hard. This takes effort. And I think it keeps your feet to the fire a little bit to read. And this book is actually, you'll find these in the library back there. There are four volumes of this. The sutta that we're using for these 4 weeks is actually in volume number one. And volume number one has a lot of the really meaty material in it. And these are translated by an American monk who's actually going to be here at the end of April, Tanisaro. Ajahn Tanisaro, he's wonderful. So if you want to start with something that's from the horse's mouth, there it is. Of course, with weaknesses that... But Tanisaro is a Pali scholar. He works very hard. You'll see in his writing, in the writings that he gives his introductions, why he's chosen to use certain words in translation rather than other words. He's a very, very exacting guy, and it's a real inspiration to read him. So I encourage you to try it if you're interested. So what the sutta does, in the same kind of language that I just gave, it walks through, it starts out with just breathing, and then, of course, becoming aware of all of the sensitivity to the body. And then it talks about doing that, developing your practice so that you can do that in all of body activities, not just sitting, but also walking and lying down and standing up. So now we've launched ourselves into a place where he's obviously pointing toward the idea that you're going to be mindful of the bare experience in your body all day long. In any activity, you're going to get so concentrated that you can actually be mindful while you're driving your car, while you're playing baseball, whatever it is, and be able to discern the difference between the bare experience and the stuff that you're layering on top of that. Then all of the other bodily activities. We haven't even gotten into, you know, what goes on when we put food in our mouth and when the food comes out the other end, and on. There's a whole nother bunch of activities that he's asking you to wake up to in terms of the bare experience. And then the interaction of the body with the four elements, earth, air, fire, water. And finally, the decay of the body in great detail. And he's pointing to the idea that in seeing the bare experience of the decay of the body, you get it, you know, you get it, that your body's going to do that. Not just my body, but yours is going to do that. I don't think mine's going to, but I know yours is going to. I'm having a real hard time on that one myself. So I'd like to... I just want to outline this because there's so much material here that to sit here and just go through this, and I really, in order to do it justice, I'd have to read it because the language is so precise. I can't possibly do it from memory, and I think that would be a disservice to all of us. So I really do encourage you, if you feel like you want to be challenged, to actually read this, read these, That's all I'm going to say about mindfulness of the breath and the body. And then next week, we'll go on to the mindfulness of feeling. And the following week, mindfulness of the mind and sensations. And in this, you'll see the language that the Buddha uses around the Buddhist psychology of how you separate between the mind and emotions and thoughts and all of that stuff. He does it in a way that is very challenging to our language because we don't do the same things. We have all kinds of words for emotions. You know, emotions are the greatest thing in the world. We got all kinds of words for emotions. He thinks they're pretty unimportant. So it goes. So, any questions? I'd like to take your question and do something with it a little bit. I would say that quieting the mind in the way you're talking about could be viewed as concentration. It's a form of concentration to simply focus your mind on just hearing the music and letting the body move. Could also be focusing on something else. It could be just looking at a candle flame or saying a mantra. And that concentration of the mind is very satisfying. The mind can become quite joyful in that highly concentrated state. Part of this meditation practice is to develop powers of concentration which have in themselves great reward. But the Buddha is pointing beyond that. He's pointing to an activity of mind, which is that at all times the mind is aware of what is happening. That the mind, if you like, you have developed this observer quality of the mind, which can step out of the process and be aware that music is coming in and the body is dancing to it, without getting in the way of that, but at the same time, it's taking note of all of the bare experience that's arising. It's taking note of the hearing, taking note of the feeling of the feet on the floor. He's pointing to something that's far more challenging than just getting concentrated. So, in this tradition, what is said is, don't stop with concentration. Don't just do that, because you do not gain the real fruits of the practice, which are this understanding of the inherent greed, anger, and delusion that we're all functioning under until we actually start to see what the real underlying characteristics of life are. Impermanence, suffering, and non-self. You cannot get to those just by concentration. So I'm not in any way lecturing you or scolding you or anything else. I'm just pointing out that that phrase, quiet the mind, is another one of those phrases where you got to think, okay, what does that quiet mean? What does he mean when he uses the word quiet the mind? Because we all mean different things by it. Well, it's a barrier until you develop the skills, the mental skills necessary to see what it's up to. These are all opinions you're talking about now. We all have opinions. I mean, it's important to know that that's what they are. They're not reality. Well, a great deal of reality is determined by people acting on things that aren't real. So that's a big problem we have as a world. We have trouble discerning the difference between reality and opinion. I mean, I could kill you because your cross is crossed the wrong way. I mean, it happens all the time. Well, I'm not, you know, we do it to other than natives. We don't seem to be very discerning about that. Yes? I did not mean to imply otherwise. I just was trying to differentiate between that kind of quietness that is brought by that and the kind of, and what mindfulness is. That's all I was trying to do. Yeah, there's nothing in this practice that says that one should not be physically active, that one shouldn't do anything. This practice is not about should nots and should do's. It's about just recognizing the differences between these activities and what they give rise to. That's all. It's an attempt to really just see how things are, and not doing any physical movement is deleterious to your health at the most basic level. I'd like to close then with a short metta meditation. In that list of things that the Buddha pointed to monks doing, he mentioned that monks were devoting their practice to loving kindness and gratitude and equanimity. And this metta practice is a practice of concentration for quieting the mind, and perhaps more importantly, for inclining the mind toward healthy habits rather than habits of self-criticism or self-loathing. It's inclining the mind toward habits of self-love and love for other people and caring for oneself and other people. And wouldn't it be nice if we could get so habituated around that instead of our mind going to those kinds of places that create suffering in ourselves, they would go to places of loving kindness. So this practice is intended to engender that. So starting with ourselves, as a person who, as much as any other person in the world, could use loving kindness, let's wish ourselves, holding ourselves however we like in our heart, perhaps a mental image of ourselves, however we do that, that feels most natural. Then wish yourself safety and good health and a strong body. And happiness and and peacefulness. And the intention to care for oneself with joy. So however, whatever phrases you find for yourself work best, repeat those to yourself quietly a few times. Now bring your attention to someone that you have strong feelings about, a loved one, partner, parent, a teacher, someone that it's easy to wish well for. Helps give rise to more power in these, more intention in these wishes. And wish that person safety and good health and happiness and peacefulness. And again, repeating the phrases that you find work best for you. Now bring your attention to someone neutral, perhaps a neighbor or someone at work or someone that you don't have either, don't have strong feelings about either way, and wish them well using the same phrases that you found work best for you. Wish them happiness and peacefulness and good health and safety. Now bring to mind someone who's more difficult. And in the spirit that we all want to be happy, difficult people want to be happy. See if you can bring some intention around wishing that difficult person safety and good health and happiness and peacefulness. And finally, bringing your attention to everyone in this room, everyone in this place, everyone in this planet, every living being, born and to be born. May all be safe. And healthy. And peaceful and happy.